All right, well, hope you guys are doing well. We're back in the book of Psalms. This is our second teaching in the book of Psalms. Psalms are a collection of 150 ancient songs to God. They're songs, and they're written to God. So they're prayers. And what's great about the Psalms is that they're inspired prayers. So they're beautiful, they're heartfelt, they're human. They're works of art, each one of them. But the Bible tells us that the Holy Spirit himself is aided in writing these. They're scripture. And so God, through these songs, can teach us, can reveal things about himself, can feed us. And that makes them pretty fun to study. There's a bunch of different types of psalms. So when you read through, you know, some psalms are praising God for who he is. Some psalms are thanking God for things that he's done. Sometimes the author is just pouring out his problems and his feelings to God, just talking to God about them. Some psalms have requests where the author is asking God to do something, to intervene, to deal with opponents or enemies. Some psalms predict the coming of the Messiah, the Savior, Jesus, and look ahead to him. Some psalms are just wisdom. They just tell us how to live a good life. And that's what we read last week in Psalm 1. It's a wisdom psalm. And the psalmist told us that if we really want to have a happy life or a life that's made happy by God, then the key is to follow his way and what he says rather than the cacophony of other ways and the way in our own heart. And that's how we have wisdom. So today, what I thought we could do is read Psalm 23. And Psalm 23 is a famous psalm. It probably is the most famous psalm. And in fact, I'm willing to bet when we read it here that you're going to be like, oh yeah, I've heard this. Or maybe you've heard it 1,000 times. Maybe you have it memorized. I don't know. But let's read it first just to get a taste for it. So this is, it's only 6 verses long. It is a psalm of David. Some of the psalms have a little tag attached to them that tell us a little bit about the author. Sometimes they tell us the circumstance that it was written in. This is a psalm of David. David was a king of Israel 3,000 years ago. Hands down, the best king of Israel. He presided over Israel at the height. He's also a really important spiritual figure in the Bible. This is what he says. Psalm 23, verse 1. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. You have anointed my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and loving kindness will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now, I first heard that psalm when I was in preschool. The Lord is my shepherd. And truly, it's a cultural icon. Right? What I mean by that is that it's one of the rare bits of Christianity that's permeated the culture, and it has for a long time and still does now. You know, the music to this, the original music, is long lost to history, but famous composers like Bach and Schubert, Bernstein, have all composed music to go with this psalm. You can hear it in popular music, too. So Duke Ellington quotes this psalm. Pink Floyd quotes this psalm. The Grateful Dead quotes this psalm. Coolio quotes this psalm. Megadeth quotes this psalm. True. In the movie Titanic, when the ship's going down, guess what the pastor's reading? Psalm 23. On 9/11, President Bush recited Psalm 23. It's a cultural icon from preschool to Megadeth. And so, you know, I'm guessing at some point it's crossed your ears before. But I don't want to take away from that. I hope what you don't take away from that is like, okay, yeah, then I already know this, and there's nothing new to hear. It's just the opposite. these words, for whatever reason, these words have been resonating with humanity for millennia. There's something profound and deep here, whether you've never heard it, whether you've heard it 1,000 times, something really important and beautiful being communicated here. So what kind of psalm is this? I think it's a psalm of praise because the author is praising God for who he is. We can learn a lot about God in this. I think it'd also be accurate to say that it's a psalm of affirmation. Because if you read it, you know, what is David really doing here? He's just affirming who God is and how God interacts with him. He's not saying new information that he's just discovered. He's just simply affirming what is true. And I think there's a lesson even in that, that when we learn spiritual truths, when we relate with God, it's not a one and done. It's not something we move on from, but it's something that sometimes the real need in our life is to come back and affirm to ourselves and to God something that is true and that we've already known. What's the topic? It's David's relationship with God. That's what he's doing in this psalm. He's affirming his relationship with God. Here's what you're like, God, and here's what I'm like in this relationship. Maybe if you've come here before, you've heard us talk about having a relationship with God. That's something we talk about all the time. The Christianity, it's not like a program. It's not a religious system, okay? It's not a method. It is, at its heart, a relationship because God is a personal God and a relational God. And what's described in the Bible is that what he really wants from us is a personal relationship with us. And that's an amazing thing to say and a true thing to say. But it's also a little bit like fuzzy. I mean, what does it mean, right? A relationship with God. How do you define that? You can't, you know, there's no one passage in the Bible that spells out, here's what that means. But I think this passage gets a lot of wood on the ball. All right, you can learn a lot about what it looks like to have a relationship with God from, not everything, but you can learn a lot from what's here. So what I want to do is just kind of take this verse by verse and see what we can learn about David's relationship with God and therefore what it is like to have a relationship with God. Sound good? All right, verse 1. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. I shall not be in want. I want for nothing. That's the idea, to want, to need. He's saying, I don't need anything. Which is a pretty intense thing to say. You know, it's a pretty blockbuster start. When in your life have you ever said, I don't need anything? You know, he starts with this expression of contentment. And it's kind of confounding because the truth is, we want for things all the time. You know, every human being has deep core needs, right? We need love, we need security, we need a purpose and identity. And then on top of that, we have all of our wants, which are innumerable. And they usually, you know, most of our wants don't get met half the time or more than half the time. And sometimes our needs don't get met, especially in this fallen world where things go wrong and where bad things happen. So how can anyone with a straight face say, I shall not want? You know, I read this and I'm like, I shall, you know, like I can make a list right now, man, of things I want. So David just kind of drops this bomb right off the bat. I'm good, he says. How can he say that? Well, it's connected to the first statement. I shall not want because the Lord is my shepherd. These two ideas are connected. Shepherds were a super common profession in the ancient world, not particularly high status, okay? People tended to look down on shepherds. It's rugged work, all right? It was outdoors. You know, the whole job of a shepherd is basically keeping this flock together, tending it as they grow, moving the sheep around to various places. And so this meant that a lot of the time, the shepherd was just out there, sometimes in the wilderness, alone for the most part. And there's the privations of the climate and the weather, the difficulty of the terrain, the threats from thieves. You know, they were really susceptible to criminals because they're alone with valuable sheep. And predators and things like that. It was a dangerous job. David was a shepherd. That's part of what makes this really resonate. If you read in the scriptures, that's who David was. He was a shepherd who, this little nobody shepherd boy who grows up to become the king of Israel. He's sometimes called the shepherd king of Israel because he held this nation together. And so here's David, the ultimate shepherd. You know, he could have written a psalm that was like, I am the shepherd. I'm the most shepherdy shepherd there ever was. What does he say? He's like, no, I'm the sheep. So it's kind of surprising. He says, the Lord, that is my shepherd. And in this relationship, I'm the sheep and he's the shepherd. And so as we read, we should try to ask ourselves, how is David like a sheep in what he's describing? And maybe more importantly, how is God like a shepherd? That's what he's affirming here. This passage tells us a lot about our shepherd. The word he's using here, Lord, whenever you see it in all caps like that, Lord, that means that it's the personal name of God, Yahweh, the God of the Bible. It roughly translates, I am. When God is asked his name, he says, my name is I am, or I am that I am. The Alpha and the Omega, that's what God says. The beginning and the end. I am the uncaused cause. I'm God. And so because I'm God, David says, or because you're God, then I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. These three go together. So he leads me beside green pastures. In the ancient Near East, it's arid. And so feeding the sheep is actually kind of difficult. There's no one place you could put the sheep where all their needs would be met. They had to move around, and so shepherds were nomadic. So in certain seasons, the sheep had to be near people so they could eat scraps from the harvest, chaff, and things like that. But in other seasons, when it rained, in Israel, there are places where the fields suddenly turn green, only during the rains. And so the shepherd would have to not only know where the resources are, but also be able to lead the sheep. We're going to go here for food. Then we're going to go there for food. Then we have to go here for water. Here's where we have to go for shade. And so what's David saying? He's saying one of the things that God does in this relationship is he provides. Or more accurately, he leads me to provision. He takes me around and gives me what I need, because by implication, he's saying, I can't provide all I need on my own. You know what happens if the shepherd leaves the sheep? They die. They're not clever. They don't go forage. You know, they don't know what to do. They need led step by step to each provision. And David says, that's what you're like, and that's what I'm like. He makes me lie down, he says, in green pastures. Not he lets me lie down. He makes me lie down. So, you know, the sheep need help, even to rest. We used to have a dog that would get so worked up whenever we had guests over and there was food. He was, you know, he would beg for the food. And he would get so worked up begging for the food that we'd get worried about him. Like, he'd be panting. And, he'd be actually, like, trembling, shaking. And he would get exhausted. And you actually had to go and, like, make him lie down. You know this if you have little kids, when they get overtired and they get crazy. We used to say they get feral, you know, and they're like out of their mind. And you're like, you're tired. And they're like, no, I'm not tired. You know, and you're like, I know that if I could get you to hold still for 30 seconds, you would be unconscious. You know, you'll fall asleep. They actually need help. That's why you swaddle a baby, right? So it stops poking itself in the eye long enough to fall asleep. David says, he makes me rest. He leads me beside quiet waters. I need help even to find peace, he says. I'm kind of like this. I mean, I'm a restless person, to be honest with you. And I never know what I need. You know, I'm always running around trying to do one thing or another. One of the habits that I developed in my life is to spend time, to go somewhere quiet outside if I can, and just walk around outside and talk to God a little bit. And here's the thing about that is I almost never feel like doing that. I very rarely desire to do that. But here is something that happens to me all the time is that when I do, and I get somewhere quiet where I can, it's just me and the sound of my own footsteps, and I start speaking honestly to God, all the time. I'm like, oh man, like this is the thing that I needed. I didn't want it, but now that I'm here, this is what I needed. I should do this all the time. I say that to myself all the time. He leads me beside quiet waters and he restores my soul. So this is kind of a thing that sometimes the psalmist will do is, you know, he's speaking in an illustration. The main point of this psalm is an illustration, right? The shepherd. And he sticks with the illustration, but sometimes he breaks out and just says what he means. You know, what does he mean by he's leading me around to these things? He's saying, I'm talking about God restoring my soul. That God provides not actual food and water and shade. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about spiritual food and spiritual water and spiritual shade, and that he restores me. We get run down in life. We get beat up. David was a warrior king. When you read through his life, he had an incredibly stressful life, perilous life. So what recharged his battery? What fulfilled David? He says, it is God who leads me to the things that I need. He says, he guides me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. So here's another thing that God does. He provides, but he also says that he guides me. So he leads. And that's really important because sheep need led. All right? Look, sheep, it's not a complimentary comparison to be compared to a sheep, okay? They're not the most noble animals. They're not known for their intelligence. They're known for their absence of intelligence. They don't have defense mechanisms. They don't have teeth or claws. You know, they don't have shells. They don't have poison quills. You know, they're just sheep. Their only defense mechanism is following the sheep in front of them. And they're bright white, so they stand out. You know, they're fairly helpless. And so without help, they die. You know, with many domesticated animals, if you release them, they go feral, right? You let a cat go, and what happens? It gets a thicker coat. It gets a meaner temperament. Some animals get bigger teeth, or, you know, pigs get tusks or whatever. I don't know how it works. You know what I'm talking about. Sheep don't have that. If you let a sheep go, it dies. They literally depend on humans. I Googled, it's fun if you're bored tonight, Google, you know, sheep doing stupid things. I found a video of a sheep that got stuck in a ditch, and here's a person trying to help it out. There are many such videos. Just wanted to pick one highlight. So what's David describing? He's describing a state of provision. I shall not want. I am provided for, but right woven in with that is a state of dependence. I shall not want because I am dependent on him, because I follow him. The Lord is my shepherd who provides. The Lord is my shepherd who leads, because sheep need led, which means that I need led. That's David's point. I need led. David the king is saying what I really need is led. And I think this is counterintuitive because, you know, we don't like the idea of being led, right? We like the idea of being the leader. Our whole idea of like true freedom and happiness is being unfettered by anyone, you know, to do whatever I want to do. But where does it lead if we do that? If I say, I am the boss of myself, well, just like a sheep, it doesn't go that well. We end up following other shepherds who aren't as good or aren't as strong. Or we end up following ourselves as a shepherd, which leads to unhappiness. That's what we learned in Psalm 1 last week. We've got a mental health crisis in our country right now. I'm sure you've seen on the news or experienced personally. You know, we're not doing well in our happiness and satisfaction. I just saw one study that just came out that 60% of young women right now today feel a pervasive sense of depression and hopelessness. 60%. Why is that? Well, I'm sure there are many reasons why, okay? But one of them has to at least in some way be connected to the fact that our cultural worldview, our whole value system says, if you want to be happy, don't ever be led by anyone. If you want to be happy, whatever you do, don't have a shepherd, especially God. But if there is a God, and if indeed we're designed like to be dependent on him, if that is true, then it makes sense that we would be unhappy if that dynamic was disturbed. When Jesus came and he walked the earth and he saw people right up close and he saw us in our sin, what does it say? Matthew 9:35. It says, Jesus was going through all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every sickness. Seeing the people, what did Jesus say when he saw the people? Did he say, they're fine, you know, it's going okay? He didn't say that. He didn't say, look at these disgusting people and their awful sin. That's not what he said either. It says, seeing the people, he felt compassion for them because they were distressed and dispirited like sheep without a shepherd. It's sad for a sheep to not have a shepherd. That's a sad thing. It's sad when a dog is loose and has no owner. And it's sad, God says, when you don't have a leader, because that's how I made you. I know we don't like to hear it. It's hard on the pride, okay, to submit to God. It's hard on the pride, but it's easy on literally everything else. Because this is how we're made, and this is who he is, and this is what David is affirming. If you feel distressed and dispirited today, if you read that and you're like, yep, that's me, there might be a lot of reasons for that. I'm sure there are. But the reason that Jesus points to is being a sheep without a shepherd. Last week we read in Psalm 1, the psalmist said, how happy is the man, how made happy by God, how blessed is the man who delights in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. Remember that? That there's two ways. There's God's way, and there's the way of any way else. And he says, the happy man is the one who follows God. And that's what he's talking about right here. He says, he guides me in the paths of righteousness. That's the exact same language as Psalm 1, the path of righteousness versus the path of the sinners. So what's cool about this, so last week we learned that's the better way to go, is God's way. What's cool about this is that he's saying, and also God helps us to do that. You know, it's one thing to say, all right, God's way is better than my way, but it's actually pretty hard to follow God's way. So do you see the incredible graciousness that's being shown here, that God says, yes, I have a way, and it's better, and I will show it to you, and also I'll help you to follow it. David says he helps me follow the way that he's given me, and he does this for his name's sake. Now that little bit there is an easy part to skip. You know, I don't know. I was reading this, and I was like, I've read this psalm a number of times. I'm not sure I ever noticed that before. Why does God guide us in the path of righteousness? It's not because I'm so charming. It's not because I'm doing such a good job that it motivates him to help me over the finish line. You know, God does love and value us, but the reason it says that he shepherds us is for his name's sake. It's actually to God's glory. It's not based on who I am. It's based on who he is, which, again, my ego doesn't love. But if you think about it, that is a much more durable foundation for God's goodness. Why does God shepherd us in a loving way? Because of who he is. And this means, too, that there is something important about us, that when we follow God, this actually glorifies him, that we are spiritually significant. We're eternally significant people, and it's eternally significant when we acknowledge him as our shepherd. God says, that is glorious. That will resound across eternity because you matter, and you and I being in a right relationship matters more than anything. He says, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. So one of the things that shepherds had to do in the ancient world was lead their sheep, you know, into the city, out of the city. That meant in Israel, that meant going up into the mountains or coming down out of the mountains. And it meant going up through narrow canyons and valleys. This is a canyon in Israel. And so you can kind of get the word picture. You know, that would be a little scary to walk through a canyon alone with your valuable sheep. You don't know what's around the next corner. Is there going to be a thief or a robber? Is there going to be a predator? David said that when he was a shepherd, he had to fight off both lions and bears. It would be scary to go up through a canyon. It makes me think of that scene in Star Wars where R2-D2 has to go up. You know what I'm talking about? The creepy canyon with the creepy Jawas and their creepy whispers, you know? Fun fact, you know where that was filmed? Death Valley. I think that's amazing. You're like, okay, get back on track, Ben. All right, fine. I actually think it's a pretty good description for what life feels like, though. Going into an unknown canyon, some parts of life are comfortable and familiar, but some parts of life are downright scary. You know, each time I'm doing something new, each time I'm facing something I haven't faced before, when a young person moves out of their parents' house, when you get married, when you have a kid, when you start a career, when you change a career, when you have a health problem, when you lose a parent, when you retire, you know, each stage of life is kind of like, I don't know what's going to be around the corner, and I know that it's not always good. And hanging over all of it is the shadow of death, the ultimate unknown, the ultimate alone, this knowledge that I am not going to last forever. He says, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Life is scary. That's just a fact. But here's what's amazing about this is that David says, even though that is true, I fear no evil. Again, another insane thing to say. I shall not want. That's how he started. I want for nothing. How can anyone say that? And here he says, even though I look at evil all around me, I don't fear. How can you not fear evil? Evil is scary. Because, he says, you are with me. Do you see the connection? I shall not want because the Lord is my shepherd, and I shall not fear evil because you are with me. I don't know what you're facing today. I don't know what canyon you're walking up into, and I don't know what's around the corner. But I do know that you have to go through it. Like, you do have to go up into that valley. But the good news is that you don't have to do it alone. And this is David's point. And that makes a big difference. When I was like 12 years old, I was on a Boy Scout trip, bike riding trip, over in Maryland. We rode into Washington, D.C. on a canal towpath. And you had buddy system, right, so that you stay safe because you get a little bit spread out. Well, one of the days, my bike chain fell off, and my buddies were jerks, and they kept riding and left me, okay? So I had to put my chain back on. By the time I got back on the road, they were nowhere in sight, and so I was alone. And I remembered that I was vaguely listening in the morning. They said, we're going to stop at the tunnel for lunch. And so I was watching for the tunnel. And I got to the tunnel, and I didn't immediately see anyone. So I was like, ooh, I don't know if they meant, like, before the tunnel or after the tunnel. But I don't see them, so I'm just going to go through the tunnel and see. The tunnel is the Paw Paw Tunnel, which is a canal tunnel. See, it has a body of water and then a narrow path on the side for animals to pull the canal boat through. It's finished in 1850. It's 3,000 feet long. It was the longest tunnel in the world. When it was built, it took 14 years. People died constructing it. And there are no lights. It's a little deceptive, too, because you think you see the light at the end of the tunnel, but what you're really seeing is the midpoint where the light is reflecting off the water. I was like, okay, I can do this. I'm just going to ride through it as fast as I can. So I got up ahead of steam, and I went in there. Well, I got about 10 feet before I realized I can't see anything, and there's a 10-foot drop down into murky water on one side and a brick wall on the other side. And so I immediately had to stop and walk my bike. It takes about 20 minutes to walk through this tunnel. And in the middle, it is pitch black. I mean, you can see a tiny pin of light over here and a pin of light over there. It's 3/5 of a mile. And so I started to get scared. Okay, and I was like, I realized I'm getting scared. That's not good. And so I had this idea that maybe if I sang, I would be less scared. And so I started to sing, "Here Comes the Sun." And the sound echoed off the inside in the most terrifying way. And I was hearing things drip down, and so I immediately stopped, and then it happened, and I started to cry. Aw. I'm 45, it's fine. I started to cry, and then the sound of my crying was echoing and scared, and I just hustled out. When I got to the other side, guess what? No Boy Scout troop. It's because they had said, "We're stopping, turn off at the tunnel for lunch, and whatever you do, don't go through the tunnel, it's not safe." So there I was alone, realizing now I have to go back. Well, this couple on bikes saw me, and they saw me crying, and they're like, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "No," you know, and they're like, "You went through the tunnel?" And I'm like, "Yeah," and they're like, "You shouldn't have done that." Well, they had lights on their bike, and so they walked me all the way back through, and about halfway through, I encountered my troop that was coming through with lights looking for me. So I had to go through that tunnel 3 times. But the point is, I was only scared for one of them, and it was the one where I was alone. David says, "I do have to walk through the valley of the shadow of death, but I don't fear because you accompany me through unknown fear and danger." Jesus said, "A good shepherd, when he puts out his sheep, he goes ahead of them." And Jesus said, "I'm like a good shepherd, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. Let me go first," he says. "You do have to go, but I'll lead." Also notice he doesn't say that he leads me to the valley of death. He leads me through. Yes, I have to go through it, but it's not my destination. My path goes through the valley of death to glory, as we'll see in a minute. He says, "Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." This is referring to the shepherd's tools. Shepherd had a rod and a staff. A rod could be like a club that you wear on your belt. It's a defensive weapon. The staff is that famous shepherd's, you know, curved stick, and that's for correcting the sheep, okay? So the sheep starts to wander over here, and you'd be like, "No, no, no," and you yank it with this. One's to fight off enemies, and one's to protect the sheep. It might be that he's referring to the same thing. Often they just had the one staff, and it doubled as a weapon. But a shepherd had to be tough. And so the Lord is my shepherd who defends me from danger. He goes first, and he'll kick the butt of anyone that tries to attack the flock. And he protects me from the danger of my own folly, which is a reference to discipline. You know, there are dangers in this world, and some of them are just my own idiocy. But what David says is, he's like, "I'm going up through this valley, and I'm looking over at this weapon that the shepherd has." And what's his response? He says, "They comfort me." A weapon is a scary thing unless it's in the hand of someone good. So what have we seen here? We've seen that there's a relationship that David's describing, and he has a part and God has a part. God's part is to provide love and leadership, provision and peace and rest and protection. That's God's part. And David says, "My part is to be a sheep," which means to follow and to obey and to submit. What's cool is he tells us a little bit more. In verse 5, he says, "You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. You have anointed my head with oil. My cup overflows." Now, this part's cool because, you know, I always try to picture like a sheep sitting at a table and like, you know, spreading a tablecloth. I'm like, this gets weird. This illustration's getting weird. I don't think it's getting weird. I think it's a different illustration. All right, this passage really has two very distinct illustrations, the sheep and the shepherd, and then a banquet with a host. He says, "You prepare a table for me." You know, on Thanksgiving dinner, right? And you spend all that time getting the house ready and preparing things. You're thinking about the guests. He says, "You have prepared a great table for me." It's a picture of hospitality. You roll out the red carpet for me. He says, "You have anointed my head with oil." In their culture, that was a way of showing hospitality. Was to anoint means just to apply. So they would actually apply oil to someone's head. Think about it. It's an arid climate. Your skin would be dry and cracked coming out of the wilderness. So they'd put olive oil on you. And it was a way of welcoming you. It's like the equivalent of taking someone's coat, pulling the chair out for them. They anoint you with oil. And it's loaded with symbolism, too, because it was also a way of honoring something or sanctifying it as special. So they anointed the temple with oil. They anointed the furniture in the temple. They anointed the robes of the priests. When a king was crowned, part of the ceremony was to be anointed with oil. The prophets were anointed, and then the kings were warned never to harm one of God's anointed. They're anointed by God. Jesus is described as the anointed one. So do you see how incredible this picture is? He's saying, you have welcomed me. You have anointed me. I'm like God's anointed. Blessed and welcomed by him. Crowned like a made man in his household. It's an honor. It's a picture of honor. And he says, you do this in the presence of my enemies. Imagine sitting at a table, eating a banquet, a luxurious banquet, and there are your enemies, and they can do nothing before you. I can rest right in the presence of my enemies. That's a description of a secure status. And he says, my cup overflows. You fill my cup, and I can't make it empty. It's like being at Applebee's. They just keep filling it. It's running over. This is a picture of abundance. And ultimately, it's a picture of grace. Isn't it cool how these two, because I don't deserve this. I don't deserve to be, for God to anoint my head with oil. I don't deserve that. I'm a sheep. I'm an idiot sheep that keeps falling in a ditch over and over. And so I like how these two pictures actually, there's a huge juxtaposition between the two of them. The lowly sheep whose job is to submit and yet then treated as royalty by God. It's a very shocking picture of undeserved favor from God. It's a picture of joy and delight and friendship. You see how relational it is. Come to my house. Have the royal treatment, says God. You're invited. You're welcomed. You're wanted. Let me host you. Just like Jesus washed the feet of his disciples. That I'm made at home. I want you to feel at home in my home, says God. I remember another Boy Scout story. When I was a Boy Scout, we went on a 50-mile backpacking trip in Wyoming in the mountains. And man, let me just tell you, we came down 5 days of being in the wilderness. I mean, we smelled horrible. We were sunburned and frostbitten at the same time. Everything we had was wet and dirty. We were hungry. I just remember feeling like I could barely walk. And where we had our trip set up to end was at the Great Yellowstone Lodge, which is like a luxury hotel, And so we just walked in there like these horrible creatures from the wilderness. And it's like, here's a hot shower and a hot meal. Here's a fresh bed sheets and a mint on the pillow. This always sticks in my mind as such a contrast. God says, I want you to come and be in my house. Surely, David says, goodness and loving kindness will follow me all the days of my life. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. This is really about God's goodness and his loving kindness. That's like the Old Testament equivalent for the word grace, which means undeserved favor and honor. He says, you do this for me, and surely you will continue to do this, that you'll follow me or pursue. It's the same word for hunt. That you'll follow me. When toddlers are little and they run around and they fall downstairs and they try to put stuff in electrical outlets, and so you spend like two whole years of your life like this, like following after them and your back hurts from that. He says, you follow me all the days of my life. That's unconditional. And he says, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. This picture, being welcomed as a guest in God's house. He says, that's where I'm going. That's my future. That's my true home, is as an honored guest in your house. Isn't it cool how these two illustrations, they're so different, and yet, man, when you put them together, it really paints an astonishing picture. Jesus said, "In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you. For I go to prepare a place for you. If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also." I'm going to make a place for you in my Father's house. Why? So that we can be together. So, pretty incredible picture that we've seen. In just by way of conclusion, I just want to point out in Isaiah 53, Old Testament prophet, he says, "All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but the Lord has caused the iniquity of all of us to fall on him." So this whole shepherding thing is actually a broad theme all throughout the Bible. Okay, in the ancient Israel, God called the leaders of Israel the shepherds of Israel. And sometimes he rebuked them, like, "You guys are evil shepherds. You're out for your own good. You're not taking care of the sheep." And one time he says, "You know what? One day I'm going to demand my sheep from you. You're doing a terrible job shepherding them. I'm going to take them from you and I'm going to shepherd them myself." And he says, "I'm going to send my own shepherd, a good shepherd." And he says, he actually says, "I'm going to send you David." But David had been dead for hundreds of years by the time he said that. So what's he talking about? He's talking about one who will come who will be like David, a shepherd king, the promised shepherd. And this king, it says, even though we've all wandered off and done our own stupid things, even though we all have guilt of our sin, he says, this shepherd is going to take the iniquity upon himself. He's going to actually bear the guilt of our sins. When Jesus came, he said, "I am the good shepherd." People know that verse, "I'm the good shepherd." It doesn't just mean I am a good shepherd or I'm like a good shepherd. He's saying, no, I'm that one. I'm the good shepherd. The one who's sent so that God can shepherd his people himself. I am the good shepherd and I know my own and my own know me. Even as the Father knows me and I know the Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep. The sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and I give eternal life to them. And they will never perish, and no one will snatch them out of my hand. And in the beginning of that section, he says, the sheep hear his voice, the good shepherd, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. This is the picture. Jesus calls us. He's like, why don't you come and follow me? And I think that's a great point to end on. Is that if you're here and you're like, okay, I'm hearing about this relationship with God, understand that the whole climax, the whole main point of the Bible is that God's like, you're invited. I'm calling your name to come and follow me. Don't be like a sheep without a shepherd. You're invited to my banquet, says God. And if you're someone who's had a relationship with God for a period of time, then I guess the question I would have for you is, what are you in want of today? David says, I shall not want. If you have something in your life that you're like, I have a profound sense of want, of privation in this life here, then the thing to do is to do what David has done. And you know, maybe the step for today is to affirm, as David has, your relationship with God. You got to bring it to the shepherd and let him lead. God, thank you for both of the pictures that you've painted for us here in this psalm. Thank you for what you do as a shepherd. Thank you for reminding us and revealing to us our true nature as those that need to depend on you and be led by you. And thanks especially for the incredible grace that you show us by inviting us into your house, by giving us the royal treatment that we don't deserve. You're such a good God. And so we praise you for what you've done here in this psalm. Amen.